I have vibes of 2021 all over again, to be frank. While it's true that this recession was waited for maybe a year and a half ago and it never happened, it doesn't mean that things are going to be amazing for the next 2 years. The US is going to go with fiscal deficits in a semi-permanent way, and that increases the volatility of growth and inflation. What are the trades that would benefit a lot from a recession?
I'd like to start off with one question, very important. What do you think the retail investor should really be focusing on right now?
I would say a few things. The first one has to do with the animal spirits that are running in the market, George.
I think
it's quite impressive. I mean, I get
impressive's a nice way to say that.
I don't know. I'm trying to be polite here, but I have vibes of 2021 all over again, to be frank. And in 2021, people made a lot of money. People also lost a lot of money in 2021 by participating in bubble-like investments, right? And when I hear that Apple today is giving up the electric car project to participate in AI, all of a sudden, a 10-year-long project given up just to be able to say, I'm Apple, I'm doing AI too, by the way. And when I see my Twitter feed, it has Supermicro computer ads now. I mean, companies that are supposed to be ultra profitable are aggressively advertising on Twitter. I don't know. It smells a bit like euphoria is taking place as we speak. Of course, Bitcoin price is up $60,000 again. It's not that far in percentage terms from the all-time highs. Which also adds to these animal spirits. I mean, people say, yeah, but it has to go another 6K. That's like 10 to 12%, which in Bitcoin price terms...
Oh, I can do that by this afternoon.
Yes, it's like it could happen tomorrow, really. So it's 1 inch away from all-time highs. And all-time highs, I want to make something clear, are generally bullish. Like when an asset is reaching all-time highs, it generally means when it's the stock market, that it's an asset that is producing good earnings, good cash flows, and therefore people are buying into it. And this narrative of, hey, it's all-time highs, you should sell it, it generally doesn't work when the economic cycle is supportive, when the underlying asset is producing cash flows. Unfortunately, most of the underlying assets we're talking about here are not producing a lot of cash flows. They're nevertheless hitting all-time highs. The economic cycle is interesting. We can discuss about it, but monetary policy is certainly not a commodity. The housing market is basically frozen. The labor market is at a point where companies aren't hiring any more full-time workers. They're basically hoarding their current labor, trying to hold off from firing them. But we are not in a hot part of the cycle, right? We are in this very vague and strange part, yet animal spirits are running loose. And I want people to, you know, have that as their big picture.
Yeah, yeah, well said. It's like back in 2021 when you just add coin to your name, or in 99 when you just add .com. It's like the exact same vibe.
I have to say, yes. In 2021, I was making jokes on Twitter. I just joined. I would say, you know, what about the Alf coin in the number of followers? That was a joke, but seriously, the situation is very animal spirits. Like if I look at option markets, for example, I'm a macro investor. So I look at all asset classes around the world, from crypto to equities to bonds to anything. If I look at the option market in equities today, what I see really, George, is that people have zero interest in downside protection. Zero interest, and a lot of uprising interest in upside. So they want to buy these out-of-the-money call options, which are going to pay big and make them rich if NVIDIA goes to $1,000 per share. But they're not interested in hedging their NVIDIA positions with puts, with protection. So if you look at stuff like the skew, for example, which is known to be a measure for the relative appetite for calls versus puts, you normally have people generally have a little bit more appetite for puts than for calls, right? It's like an insurance premium. People pay a bit for puts. They're a little bit more expensive. And this measure now of skew is as low in certain cases as it was in 2021. So again, it gives me vibes of people are really not interested in downside protection anymore. They're reaching for the upside. And again, there is quite some euphoria going on. If you look at credit spreads, another macro indicator, which is quite interesting. So the additional cost that corporates must pay on top of the government yield, basically,
right,
to borrow.
Like a tenure, right? Yeah.
So there is a credit risk in a corporate issuing a bond rather than the government. So they need to pay a premium. Well, that premium, that credit spread, is basically almost at the lowest levels in 10 years. So that means investors are not demanding a lot of premium, right, to buy these corporate bonds. They're pretty comfortable that it's going to be fine. You'll see all these behaviors in different asset classes, and they all point to a high level of relaxation, I would say, towards risks. And that's a bit funny to me, because while it's true that this recession was waited for maybe a year and a half ago and it never happened, it doesn't mean that things are going to be amazing for the next 2 years. And assets are priced basically to perfection as we speak.
Yeah. I heard a quote the other day from a very successful hedge fund manager. He said, just manage your downside and the upside will take care of itself.
Awesome quote. So one of the risk management parts that I use, and it's a similar way of saying, not exactly the same, but you're going to be wrong about 50% of the times when investing. That's true for everybody. So when you see somebody on Twitter says that he's always right, it's clearly bullshit. Clearly bullshit. It's marketing. But so if you invest or have invested for a long time, you know you will have some ideas, and some will be right, some will be wrong, George. We're humans. We are right 50% of the times, so wrong 50% of the times. But the trick is try to be wrong but small, and right and occasionally very big when you're right.
Asymmetry.
Correct. It's all the idea of asymmetry, really. And that's how the best investors out there make money. They're not right 80% of the times. They're right 55% of the times, but they're right big when they are, and they're wrong small.
So let's talk about portfolio construction. If your worldview is the market is wildly overpriced, and you know, I'm very fortunate that I've got some good buddies in St. Bart's who were and are very successful hedge fund managers. And I've had the opportunity to sit down with them and watch their entire process from A to Z. And I noticed one person they reference as like a mentor is Bruce Kovner.
Okay.
And I'm Bruce Kovner. He's an OG. I'm sure you know who he is. And Market Wizards books goes all the way back to the 1980s. But the way he really did it and the way that I see them do it is they start with a macro view.
Yeah,
that we're going into a global recession or the stock market's overpriced or something like that. And then they sit there with their traders and they say, okay, this is our view. How do we set up our portfolio to have the maximum asymmetry possible? And most of the time, it's not just shorting the S&P 500 or buying puts or something like that. It gets super, super technical where they're going through all of these strategies to make sure that they're, you know, taking care of their downside and then hoping that they have as much upside as possible. So I would pose the same question to you. If that's your macro view that the stock market is overpriced, how do you express that bet?
So for instance, if let's say you walk back to the pre-pandemic period, George, just to make an example, then I'll get to today, okay? So somewhere like February 2020 or January 2020, we were at the onset of COVID, okay? And it wasn't clear actually what it was. I mean, you just had some cases in China, some cases in north of Italy. Nobody knew what this thing was, right? So back then, I was working for a very large European bank, and they said, Alf, we need some scenario analysis, some risk assessment. So what's that? We have some cases of this COVID thing. We don't know what it is. Can you have a look at respiratory illnesses in the past and see how they develop? You know, make a worst case scenario analysis, okay?
Right.
So I opened my Excel. I still remember it to this day. And I went through and I followed what was the mildly exponential function, but still an exponential function of the previous respiratory illnesses, right? And then I said, if it's in north of Italy, it starts here. And then you scroll the exponential function on Excel. And at some point, it would be like, I don't know, like 40% of the adult population would be infected. Something along these lines, okay? And then you wonder like, whoa, you know, there are open borders in Europe, so that can go easily to France and any other place. And of course, nobody knew like the entity. It could have been lethal, not lethal at all. You don't know that. You only know how many people will be infected, right? And I remember when I looked at this thing and I presented it at the committee, there was a very smart guy that said, okay, we need protection. And I said, and I remember somebody else saying there, why? Like, you know, you don't even know the intensity of this thing. But he was thinking in asymmetry terms. He was saying, look, if this scenario here has only a 10% probability of being the realized scenario.
Yeah, but it's the end of the world.
The magnitude of the impact is so large.
Right.
That your the so-called expected value of your loss. So basically the probability of the event happening times the magnitude of the event happening, it's so large because of the magnitude, right? That you still need to hedge your positions. And so we discussed, and exactly there, I remember we were looking at the various positions of the bank, right? And so the bank has a bunch of positions in credit, a lot, like they make loans to corporates, etc. They have a lot of bonds, they have other positions, currencies, etc. And we had a look at the cost of protecting against a corporate default cycle. So what if XYZ corporate would default because the world would basically be shut down? That was the worst case scenario, okay? And then you run it up. And I remember that effectively you could structure trades through options where you pay the premium upfront to buy this protection. Yep. And if the default cycle would pick up close to your expectations, you would make 15 to 20 times your initial payoff.
Or your credit default swap back in.
Yeah, similar CFC. Structure, similar structures to that, right? I think Bill Ackman did something similar as well during the pandemic. He was famous for that. And when you think about it, that's, for example, I think it's a decent example of how people think because they don't approach it in white or black at the professional level. They look at scenarios. They make an analysis of probabilities and the magnitude of the impact. Then they estimate the expected value. So how big really is risk times the magnitude of the risk? How big is this event on my portfolio? And what is the best possible structure where I don't pay a lot of insurance premium to basically be able to protect against this scenario, right?
Yeah.
Now, that's the way that people look at hedging, people look at convexity and asymmetry. But honestly, when you ask me about portfolio construction, that's the easy part because I'm sitting here. We don't have to look at how much premium I'm spending. I can just tell you the framework, but ultimately you have to pay. It's an insurance premium, George. You can be smart, you can set it up in smart ways, but it's an insurance premium. So the other, and if you keep spending insurance premium and nothing happens, then you just lose money. And that's not what a good investor does, right? So a good investor tries to look at what are the premiums that he can spend that can potentially pay off very large, but also what are the underpriced assets in markets so that if everything goes okay, so it ends up in the middle of the distribution, there is no realized big, big risk, he gets paid because the initial price that he pays for that asset was fair or below fair value.
Right.
That's also important. It's the most boring part of the business, but it is important. So a portfolio cannot always be something where it's full risk on or full risk off, or as you said, extremes, right? Buy a put or go long the NASDAQ. That's not how it works. It should be a smart combination of paying premium in a smart way. So hedging basically where the expected value is large, but the market isn't charging you a lot to hedge for that large expected downside. And vice versa, looking at markets where today you're paying a fair or less than fair value for the assets you're buying if the world ends up being okay. And that combination is the way that the best investors out there construct their portfolio with.
Yeah, and if you're worried about recession, if you're looking at the curve, you're worried about recession and you're thinking, okay, that's got to impact the stock market. And I'm just going to kind of what I see in my comments all the time. Yeah. And this, and therefore I'm going to go ahead and just max out a credit card to short the S&P 500. I've said to those people, you know, I can't give you investment advice, but what I would do with my portfolio is I would prefer to go long the 2-year treasury as opposed to short the stock market, because if we do have that recession, who knows what the government's going to do? Who knows what the Federal Reserve's going to do? Are they going to buy shares? I mean, you just have no way. You don't have that crystal ball.
Yeah.
But you do know that they're going to drop rates.
Yeah.
And so what do you think about that?
I think it's very smart. I mean, one of the other lessons that I learned is don't proxy trade. So if you have a certain scenario in mind, what is the asset that most closely relates to that exact macro scenario you just discussed? So I hear people, for example, saying, China is too much underpriced. There are too many risks priced in, and therefore they want to buy Chinese or Chinese growth story. They think Chinese policymakers are going to stimulate. I don't agree, but whatever the narrative is, they want to buy Chinese assets. Okay, and then they say, "I'm going to buy copper."
Oh, right.
I'm like, sorry, mate. Like, you want to buy Chinese assets? Yeah, but copper is correlated to China because when China stimulates, then copper goes up. When China stimulates and they build bridges and infrastructure and houses in the desert, in the middle of nowhere, then yes, copper goes up. But what if this time they stimulate by handing money over to people in China? They could if they want to. It's a super centralized economy. It's very easy for them to achieve that. They don't want to. That's a different story. But what if they did, George? Then would copper be the best way to do this, or would just be buying Chinese consumer stocks? Right? Yeah. Because the consumer, so basically try not to proxy trade, but try to be as close as you can to the origin of your trade idea. In your case, let's say I have a model that takes the option implied bond market probabilities, and it says today that bond traders are pricing a recession at a 10% probability only over the next 12 months. Okay. 10%, okay?
Yep.
This number used to be 45% during the banking crisis in March last year. 45% on a 12-month forward. So kind of base case. It didn't happen. So it was a wrong pricing. Today, it's 10%, okay? And generally, as a recession tends to happen about once every 10 years, we can say 10% is really not a lot. You're basically getting a fair pricing for a recession optionality, right? You're paying a relatively fair premium on a 12-month forward. Right now, if you go around to like my clients and you say, hey, I'm looking to buy some recession optionality here, they look at you like, are you nuts? What recession? Which is generally a good indicator that people are not positioned for it anymore, because understandably, people have been wrong for a long period of time and recessionary trades are expensive. You need to pay a premium. And if nothing happens, then it's not a great idea to keep owning these trades, right? But today, it's priced at a relatively convenient entry price, right? So what you could do today is say, what are the trades that would potentially benefit a lot from a recession? That's basically your line of thought. And then you say, what's the closest possible asset class related to that? And I think people make this common mistake of saying, I'm going to buy 30-year treasuries. I'm going to buy 10-year treasuries. There are too many degrees of freedom into that, because the front end of the curve is the one that fully incorporates the Fed cutting cycle. So if there is a recession, you know that the Federal Reserve reaction function is going to be to cut interest rates much more than what it is priced today.
Right.
Today, we're priced for 3 cuts this year, maybe a few more next year. That's it, right? But history shows that if you get a recession, the Federal Reserve on average cuts about 400 basis points in 18 months. That's the standard cutting cycle to fight a recession, like in 2001 or in 2009, for example. Okay, that was the cutting cycle. 400 basis points from here is much more than the 5 or 6 cuts priced for the next 18 months. It's a lot more, right? So 2-year interest rates would reflect these cuts and they would drop dramatically. And if you have locked them in at higher interest rates, you would actually make money.
Yep.
This would be the nature as well of the famous bull steepening of the yield curve. So what happens is the typical pattern is the yield curve inverts. It stays inverted for a very variable period of time, by the way. It can be inverted for 12 to 27 months. The longest inversion was just prior to 2008 crisis. The yield curve stayed inverted for 27 months, and people had given up at some point, right? They thought soft landing, that time was different. That was 2007. Now we're at month number 23 on the type of inversion that I personally track. So it's a very long
cycle.
Which
one is that, Alf?
I'm looking at the 2-year to 10-year, but not using the government bond curve, but using the OIS curve, the overnight index swaps, which basically is a pure proxy of Fed funds.
Okay.
So it's not taking into account repo markets, swap spreads, and other stuff. It only looks at the Fed funds as priced by the market. So the market expectation for Fed funds, and that 2-year to 10-year curve has been inverted for 23 months now. Okay, it was 27 in 2008. I think the jury is still out. It's definitely a long cycle. One has to admit it's a very, very long lag. But the typical pattern is you get this persistent yield curve inversion. It never disinverts for a long period of time. Then you would get a bull steepening of the curve, right before you actually get the recessionary labor market. So the US isn't adding any jobs anymore. It's zero or slightly negative on the non-farm payrolls. That's the typical sequence, okay? And in that case, the curve indeed bull steepens. Why? Because as we discussed, the front end of the yield curve is the one that drops so rapidly, reflecting the Federal Reserve cutting cycle. The long end of the curve, the yields, also drop, but sometimes they can't follow how fast the front end is dropping. And why is that? Well, a couple of reasons. It could be because the market thinks that the Fed cutting so much will rescue the economy. You know, right. Down the road, maybe in 3 to 4 years, we have exited the recession. And so 30-year yields are a reflection of what the economy will be 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10, 20 years from now. And so if they cut rates, then maybe you can steepen again back on the growth curve and the inflation curve. Or maybe it's the supply of bonds. Maybe the market starts to think like, well, now that we are in a recession, if these guys are doing a 5-6% deficit in normal times,
yeah, what's the GDP, deficit? Just to be clear for the audience, he's talking about deficit to GDP,
the percentage of GDP. So, yeah. What are they going to do if we get into a recession? Right, it's going to be 10% maybe, and they want to reflect some premium in the long end of the curve because they know that bond supply will be coming. There are plenty of reasons, but as you said, the closest expression of your idea is not a 10-year bond. It's not shorting the stock market. The closest expression is to buy 2-year bonds or also to buy gold, for example. That's a similar type of idea where you say, if interest rates are dropping dramatically and economic conditions are deteriorating, gold generally can serve as a good asset in that case because the competing form of money for gold, which is dollars, dollars are now yielding less. So on a comparable basis, the dollars aren't yielding 5% anymore. They will be yielding 2 or 1 at that point, right? So on a comparative basis, gold becomes more attractive than before. So people are going to marginally move their money from dollars into gold, also for a sense of protection. So gold could benefit in that environment. Yet, what if you get margin calls? What if during a drawdown, George, people are forced to liquidate every asset they can to raise cash?
Even then gold, that's what we saw in 2008.
They will also liquidate gold exactly like in 2008, exactly like in March 2020, exactly the same. Where people will ask me, what the hell is going on? The world is upside down and gold is selling off? Yes, man, when you have to meet your margin calls, you will sell every asset you have. The name doesn't matter. Actually, if the asset has gone up, like gold, you will sell it because it has actually raised more cash for you to meet your margin calls, to pay down your debt. You will actually have to sell the asset that makes the most money for you in that case. And gold can be trapped exactly there in between for a bit, for a few weeks, right?
Yeah.
But it actually can work against you. Again, do not proxy trade. Get as close as you can to the source of your macro trade idea.
Yeah, it's great advice. I heard Einhorn say pretty much the exact same thing the other day on a podcast where he was asked about what are some tips that you would give to like a global macro trader. That's the very first thing that he said. And on that note, where are you right now?
Where am I? Located physically?
Yeah.
Unfortunately for me, in the dark and cloudy Netherlands. And not in my hometown in Italy. Yeah.
Okay, so give us some insights as to what is happening in Europe. And I want to look at this through the lens of potentially a global recession and then how that would play out in the United States. Because right now, to your earlier point, everyone is saying, my gosh, the United States economy is booming. There is no recession. That's just complete fake news. All you have to do is look at the stock market and look at the unemployment rate. Mm-hmm. But then I look at Japan. I look at the UK. I look at Germany. I think just today or yesterday, it was Finland that came out as well. Ireland is just getting crushed. I saw that. But a lot of these countries in the Eurozone have come out, along with the UK, Germany, and Japan, and said, oh, by the way, guys, we are in a recession right now. Mm-hmm. Not that we're forecasting one. We're in one. And then when you look at their unemployment rates, they're all very low. Yeah. You look at the stock markets, they're all at all-time highs. Yeah. So I'd like your thoughts on that. And then can the United States avoid a recession based on what we see all over the world, including China, where they're having the most deflation that they've had in decades?
Yeah. So bad news is good news until bad news is bad news, basically. That's how the market works, right? So bad news is good news because if it's bad, but not bad enough, then ultimately it means that you know, you got to be cheery because central banks are going to come to the rescue. And so, you know, it's bad news, but ultimately it's good news because central banks are coming. Yeah. That's how markets really think, right? And so I think in Europe, we are in that situation right now. But let me take a step back and make the difference between these countries that you just mentioned. They're perfect examples, the UK or Europe and the United States, okay? So why are we in this different economic cycle, really? And I think the answer is twofold. So the United States economy has been relatively resilient to the increase in interest rates for a couple of reasons. The first one is that after the great financial crisis, because of the excessive private sector leverage entering the financial crisis in the US, people have been burned badly by the housing crisis in the US in 2008 and 2009. So they have realized that getting all that private sector leverage, having multiple mortgages without an income and so on and so forth, wasn't actually a great idea. And so what they did is they deleveraged. Okay, so they've reduced their private sector debt, and who's taken the baton of levering up in the United States has been the government. So the US government has expanded their deficit slowly but surely, injecting money into the private sector and basically making sure the private sector could deleverage a bit. Now, don't get me wrong. It's not like the US doesn't have any private debt anymore. It still does. But compared to the before 2007, the private sector in the US has a bit deleveraged.
Yeah. Okay? So they've got more balance sheet capacity.
Correct. So if interest rates are going up, but your private debt is not particularly large, it's going to have an impact, but it's going to have less of an impact than if you're highly, highly leveraged on your balance sheet, right? So the rise in interest rates has been having a bit less of an impact than it would have had, for example, in 2007, point one. Point two, households in the US have been pretty smart, but also corporates. Like, they've used this low interest rate period of 2017 to 2021 in the US to lock in low interest rates for a long period of time. So 30-year mortgages in the US were below 3%, and the mortgage production volumes were incredibly large, showing that people aren't stupid, George. And if you give them the opportunity to lock in nominal fiat borrowing at 3% or lower for 30 years, they will take it. They will take it. So corporates did the same, by the way, in the US. So they locked in corporate borrowing. So they basically issued bonds or got loans for long, long periods of time, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years at low interest rates. Why do I mention that? When you raise interest rates as the Federal Reserve, your idea is to slow down the economy. And how do you slow it down? Is by saying, George, you have a mortgage. Next time you have to refinance your mortgage, your interest rates will be much higher. So you will then be on your 4K salary a month. You'll be forced to spend more money in debt servicing. You'll spend less money in, you know, your consumer spending habits, and that will slow down the economy. For corporates, they'll do the same by saying your debt is much more expensive, so you'll have less capex, less investments, less hiring, because you'll have to focus more on servicing your debt. That's the mechanism that slows the economy. But what if corporates and households have instead locked in long interest rates at very low levels? What if they don't need urgently to refinance? Think of mortgages. Like, what if they don't need to sell? What if they don't need to refinance? Does it matter if the new mortgage rate is 7%? Yes, it matters for the new buyer. Okay, so you see a frozen housing market. But does it hurt the existing homeowner? No, and unless he needs to sell, unless he's forced to sell, it doesn't, and to refinance, it doesn't really hurt him. So you gain time. If you lock in low interest rates for a long period of time, it takes longer until the rise in interest rates can negatively impact households and corporates.
Hey guys, I want to invite each and every one of you to join me May 31st through June 2nd in Orlando for Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the annual conference I do, and this year it's going to be absolutely incredible. We're going to have some of your favorites there as speakers, guys like Jeff Snyder, Mike Green, The Real Estate, Kenny McElroy. We're going to have Robert Barnes. They're talking about freedom and liberty. Even Rich Cooper is going to be there discussing red pill issues. This event is all about giving you the intel, the insider information you need to not only survive 2024, but thrive. The whole reason I created this event was to give you the tools you need to build the future you deserve for yourself and your family. This is an event you are not going to want to miss. So to get more information, go to rebelcapitalistlive.com. You can see a full list of speakers we've had in the past. You can see clips from past events. And most importantly, you can get your tickets. As we get closer to the event, the tickets go up in price. So you're going to want to get those ASAP at rebelcapitalistlive.com. And we will see you in Orlando, May 31st through June 2nd.
Yep. When the refinancing cycle kicks in, that's when you get hit, right? But it takes longer to kick in this time. That's what I'm trying to say. Additionally, the floating rate mortgages and the floating rate corporate bonds and loans as a share of total in the United States are very low, contrary to 2006, 2007. So most of the interest rate is fixed. If you raise interest rates, you're not going to pass through the cost immediately to mortgage owners because it's a fixed interest rate, not a floating interest rate. So once fixed, it's always fixed. Now, you see these three components, the low share of floating rate mortgages and floating rate corporate issuance, a bit of deleveraging that has happened in the United States, right? And the, let's say, the maturity of this private sector debt that has been prolonged very smartly by the private sector in the US before the increase in interest rates. Take that and try to apply this to Europe.
Yeah, it's the opposite.
You will see that not a lot works. So, for example, in Italy or in Spain, 45% of the mortgages are on a floating rate basis, which means the ECB hikes rate. I am an Italian. I feel it now. I don't have to wait. You know, my mortgage expenses go up immediately. My salary as an Italian hasn't gone up for 30 years, I guess, in real terms. So that means I have the same amount of disposable income at the beginning of the month, but I have to pay much more in mortgage interest costs now, George. Right. I can't wait. It's now. It's hitting me now. Second, in certain European countries, and that is particularly true for the Northern Europe, surprisingly for many, the north part of Europe is much more indebted on a private sector debt than the southern part of Europe is. So Finland, that you just mentioned, the Netherlands, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, all these countries have a very high private sector debt as a percentage of GDP. Okay, so the opposite of what I said to the US is true. While the US has deleveraged, so the private sector debt has gone down a little bit, North Europe hasn't deleveraged. They've actually leveraged their private sector from the great financial crisis. So there is more debt, basically, that is charged more through floating interest rates. And cherry on top, the refinancing cycle in Europe is much more imminent than it is in the US. And right. Why? And why? In 2015-16, in Europe, we had negative interest rates, a beautiful phenomenon where you are paid to borrow. Okay, that's amazing. So a couple of corporates said, that's great. I'm going to issue as many bonds as I can. And that was the case in 2016 and 2017. The average tenor of these European corporate bonds is 7 years. So now you make the math, 2017 plus 7 equals 2024, which means that all the freaking bonds are coming due now for refinancing, and right. Corporate borrowing rates in Europe have gone up from 1.5% to 5%.
Oh my gosh.
So if you were a corporate, every business model in Europe works because corporate borrowing rates were so low. You know, every business model works if you borrow at nothing percent. Now try to borrow at 5%. And a few of them don't work. The same goes for the UK. Similar setup. Sweden, same story. And that explains why these countries are running at a GDP of 0% already for 12 months, right? It explains why the passage and the tightening of monetary policy gets through much more quickly and intensely than it gets through in the United States.
That's a great explanation. So then the question becomes, can the United States avoid that? Because as you're describing the United States, obviously that isn't even an opinion. You're just stating fact. But it is true that while someone has a 30-year fixed rate mortgage, they also have other costs that are associated with that house, such as insurance, such as property taxes, such as maintenance. So if their real incomes are actually going down, even though they're nominal incomes are going down, they could be still forced into a position where they have to sell that house. Although, to your point, it may take a lot longer. Same thing with the corporates. You know, if they've got to pay people higher and higher and higher wages, that's going to decrease their margins. That's less money that they can allocate to a higher interest rate when they have to roll that over.
Yeah. Look, the key to the house of the macro conditions in the US is in the labor market, George. Like, if you get some cracks showing up in the labor market, so the moment that companies don't hoard labor as aggressively as today, because companies are not hiring aggressively. If you look under the hood and you look at full-time hiring, if you look at not the part-time, the multiple job holders, I'm talking about full-time hiring from United States corporates, you will see it's pretty slow today. Very, very close to 0% on a year-on-year basis. Additionally, you will also see that it's true that people are not, that companies are not firing actively. That's also true. So layoffs are very low at the moment. But also it's true that people aren't quitting their jobs anymore. So the job market has cooled down. People feel it. They're not quitting their jobs. They're not taking any risks anymore. But at the moment, it's a frozen job market. So companies aren't hiring aggressively. They aren't firing either. People aren't quitting jobs. It's like, you know, a stasis in the labor market, a bit like it is in the housing market to a certain extent. And we need to figure out how do we solve that fragile equilibrium, right? And look, if the Federal Reserve would start cutting interest rates proactively, okay, right now, they would probably have some, you know, insurance towards a bad resolution of this fragile equilibrium, because maybe they cut interest rates and companies feel more comfortable in hiring again and so on and so forth. But the Fed is afraid. The Fed is afraid of making the mistakes of the 1970s, George. You know, they're there and they're watching this inflation come down and they're not sure. Should we go for it? Should we wait a bit longer? The longer you wait at tight financing conditions, tight credit conditions, at tight interest rates, the longer you wait, the more you increase the chances that this fragile equilibrium sorts itself on the bad outcome, not on the good outcome. So the Fed here is called to make a difficult decision, I think. Some people say, oh, look, the annualized core PCE, which is the measure they target on inflation, is already at 2%. It was 1.6 at some point if you took the 3-month or the 6-month annualized rate. But then you get the January print and you get a pickup in inflation. And it looks like 2.5% now. So if you are the Fed, it's a decision of trying to proactively ensure the good outcome by taking a risk on inflation, or keeping policy tight for long and taking a risk that, you know, you tweak the scale towards a bad resolution of this fragile equilibrium. I think Powell wants to wait. I think he wants to be conservative. He wants to make sure that inflation is going to 2%. So he's taking a risk that the bad outcome actually realizes.
I've told many people to try to put themselves in the position of Jerome Powell. Mm. And if you think about it, he has all the incentive to err on the side of a hard landing. Because if he has a hard landing, he's a hero. He's Paul Volcker. if he takes that risk that, well, maybe I should start cutting rates now, now all of a sudden he is risking Arthur Burns. Because even though that might be the path to a soft landing or no landing, you're risking, I don't think there's too much of a risk, but in his mind, he's risking a reacceleration of that inflation that, again, makes him look like Arthur Burns when his grandkids look back on history. So he has every incentive to actually create a hard landing or err on the side of keeping rates too high.
I think you're right. If you look at his personal incentive scheme, the guy's going to retire in a few years. So if you're him, probably you want to make really sure that nobody can point at you as the guy who reaccelerated inflation by cutting interest rates too early. I think from a personal incentive scheme, that's where he stands right now. And look, the Fed has kept interest rates above 5% for 3 quarters already. That's quite some time. And by the looks of things here, in March, they aren't going to cut. In April, probably not even. So we are going to go to June. By the looks of things as per today. So that's going to be almost a full year of interest rates above 5%. So I think you're right. He's erring on the side of caution, but that comes with side effects, which is that the US economy is strangled by this prolonged frozen labor market and housing market. And then
we haven't even talked about commercial real estate.
Oh, yeah. Well, don't get me started there. I mean, the risks are abundant and people are surprised on why the US economy has held resilient so far. I've given an explanation based on the level of private sector debt, the trends in private sector debt, the floating rate versus fixed rate story, and for how long people have locked in and corporates have locked in their cheap funding. And I think that's important. The other story, of course, is fiscal, George. I mean, like, there was a world once upon a time where politicians would use fiscal stimulus as a anti-cyclical weapon. So when unemployment rate was going up, fiscal deficits were expanded. When the economy was weak, fiscal deficits were expanded. But when the economy was strong and unemployment rate was low, fiscal deficits were actually tightened up, right? So you had sometimes even a fiscal surplus if the economy was very strong. So it was an anti-cyclical, not a pro-cyclical use of fiscal deficits.
Yeah.
And right now, I mean, geez, man. I mean, it started with Trump in 2016, 2017. You had unemployment rate moving down, and then he proceeded with a large number of tax cuts. So he started the trick, but to be honest, Biden learned it very quick. So in 2023, he came in with a bazooka deficit-like fiscal spending, and unemployment rate was below 4%. So it seems like it's not even a partisan discussion anymore. It's just a thing. You know, the U.S. is going to go with fiscal deficits in a semi-permanent way, and that increases the volatility of growth and inflation. And I think people are not used to it anymore, because we just came from 8 to 9 years of zero macro volatility in growth and inflation. So every year you knew that GDP was going to be between 1 and 2% in real terms in the US, and that inflation was going to be 1.5 to 1.8%. You just knew it. I mean, the dispersion was zero, the volatility was zero, the unpredictability was zero. And now we will probably live in a world where, because fiscal deficits are used in size and they are used pro-cyclically, there will be points where growth and inflation have explosive upside and downside moves much more often than what people are used to. And I think that's important for people to understand.
Yeah, I always say the 1940s. I mean, I got that from Lynn, you know, my good friend and business partner. She started saying that in the probably 2020. And when I thought about that, I'm like, you know, it totally makes sense. It's not the 1970s, it's the 1940s.
Yeah, I think the 40s are a better way to frame this. Of course, the economy is different when it comes to its structure. It makes sense. We have had 90 years of technological development. That's important to bear in mind, because the background of AI and technology remains there. Okay, it's like a big picture theme that you need to bear in mind. But when it comes to the volatility of inflation and growth, and when it comes to what the policymakers might be ready to do in certain circumstances, the 1940s are a great, great comparison period. You know, you had basically yield curve control or the likes of it back then. And I'm not going to say it's an absolute outcome, but it's something that I can see happening. It's something that I can see in the toolbox of developed market central banks. It's not a Japanese thing only for the next decade. It might actually be even a Fed thing or an ECB thing or a Bank of England thing. And the use of fiscal deficits is going to be so much more prominent.
What tool were you referring to, Alf?
The yield curve control.
Okay, got it.
So, I mean, it could be that. It could be other ways. But in general, you should be ready for much more volatility around the reaction function of policymakers, around growth, around inflation. So when you think of portfolio construction, right, in a world like that, I mean, people I talk to, they have been so spoiled, George. Like, if you owned a portfolio of stocks and bonds for the last 9 years, your average return was like over 10% a year, and your average volatility was 7 to 8% a year. So basically, you had no major drawdown, no major vol, and every year you get paid 10%, 10%, 10%, 10% on a passive portfolio that consisted of basically two assets. And I think when I talk to people, that's what they want to do again. That's what they want. They want a passive portfolio of two assets that's going to pay them 10% a year.
Yeah, well, you're talking about two asset classes, but now it literally is two assets, and the fact that the whole stock market's NVIDIA.
Well, you're right. I'm talking about two ETFs, let's say. But right now, it might be as well just two assets, really.
Right.
Like, you can buy a 30-year bond, and you can buy or a 10-year bond NVIDIA, and you're done. No, I mean, that's what people strive for. They strive for becoming richer. 10% a year is a massive return. Without taking any risk, so no volatility, no drawdown, onto assets or asset classes. So they don't have to think about portfolio construction and alternatives. And I think if I'm right on the macro volatility going forward, you got to think a lot harder about when and what do you put in your portfolio to protect against the several possible scenarios that are out there? What if we get an inflationary spike, but growth isn't going up? What if growth comes from emerging markets for a period of time and not from the US? Because in the US, maybe we're using resources in a very unproductive way for a period of time. What if fiscal becomes a problem? So the bond vigilantes that were in action in the UK in October 2022, when there was the crisis with Liz Truss that tried to have an expansionary fiscal deficit budget on top of inflation at 10%, and the vigilantes went in and the sterling sold off and 30-year bond yields went through the roof. And they had to oust her, literally. There was a new PM in 10 days, man. Otherwise, the UK market wouldn't be faring so well. So what if you get an example like that, maybe in Europe or in the US? Is your portfolio ready for that? Not with stocks and bonds.
And I think about the dollar too, Alf, because everything that you're talking about with Europe, with all the short-term debt, I see dollar just ripping higher while you've got, ironically, consumer price inflation in the United States. So it's going down against goods and services here, but against every other currency, it's going much higher, which puts that much more of a burden on those entities that have dollar denominated debt. And as we know, that's a large percentage of entities outside the US.
Yeah, so latest estimates in a paper I wrote, I think a year ago, was about $12 trillion of dollar denominated debt issued by entities outside the US, $12 trillion, that is, okay?
That's probably just with non-banks.
Yeah. And we're talking about non-banks here. I'm not even talking about how banks are getting their dollar funding done, which is oftentimes through other, let's say, financial sector machineries and not through issuing bonds denominated in dollars. So cross-currency swaps, FX forwards, and the likes of it. But not even counting that, so just literally looking at the bonds and the loans that are out there outstanding in dollar, George, issued by corporates, non-financial corporates, and households or similar entities outside the United States, it's $12 trillion. It's a huge amount, okay? And, you know, as long as the machine is running and a Brazilian corporate which has issued a dollar bond can sell their soybeans in dollars and the world is flowing and trade growth is higher, it's okay. You know, it's okay. You grow your cash flows and your assets in dollars, so you can service your dollar debt. But the moment the party stops and, you know, trade flows go down, then that's a problem.
What are you talking about there, guys? Velocity.
Yeah, pretty much, right? So when the velocity of the circulation of dollars outside the United States slows down, by the construct of our system, the euro-dollar system, you're basically applying pressure on everyone who has liabilities in dollar but can't get access to dollar cash flows, right? That's when you start seeing emerging market panic and you start seeing this kind of deleveraging in emerging markets in particular. But of course, the dollar will appreciate. It's like a vacuum, basically. It will suck everything because everybody needs to get their hand on the cash dollars to be able to survive and pay their liabilities, which are denominated in dollars.
Right. The only way they can do that is selling the other currencies on their balance sheet, which just exacerbates the problem.
Yeah, that's correct. So that's the how the system is designed. And I mean, it's another of these things where I could talk to you for hours about the monetary system.
I know we're getting short on time here, buddy. So just lastly, I text you the other day because I'm trying to think through this for a paper that I'm writing on de-dollarization. Mm-hmm. Because my argument is that would actually make the dollar go higher against other currencies. Yeah. And but the key to my argument is really the short-term maturity outside the United States with the majority of that dollar-denominated debt. So I've looked at all these BIS reports on dollar funding markets and whatnot, and then I just try to use common sense and say, okay, well, how many mortgages or auto loans are outside the United States in dollars? Probably very few. So then you go down, okay, corporates. Well, corporates, you're probably looking at under 5 years. And then interbank, you're probably looking at under a year. So on average, whether that number is 12 or 20 or 30 or 40, you're probably looking at a maturity around, let's just say, a year. Yeah. Well, that really, really matters because even if people wanted to de-dollarize, sell dollars, at a certain point, there's going to be other entities that have to have those dollars very, very quickly to pay off those debts. So that's going to prevent the dollar from going down substantially. But I can't find specific data on that. And I know you're neck deep in this stuff. So yeah. Is my assumption true that the majority of that dollar denominated debt issued by banks outside the U.S. is going to be very short term, maybe on average right around a year or so?
So the banks in Europe, for example, or in the UK, get most of their dollar funding in the cross-currency swap market. So basically there they would post euro collateral and they would get dollar funding against it, okay? And that market is quite deep and developed in maturities around 2 to 5 years.
Okay.
So it's a relatively short. You have to roll over this funding time over time, because European banks have figured out that issuing dollar loans is actually a very profitable business. Interest rates are higher. The business in dollars is pretty large right around the world. So they want more customers. They started issuing dollar loans. So where is the dollar funding? A European bank doesn't have direct access to the Federal Reserve unless it also has jurisdictions in the United States. For most European banks, that's not the case. So in order to get your dollar funding, you do that in cross-currency swap market. Your funding is pretty short, 2 to 5 years. It needs to be rolled pretty frequently, right? So your point is correct that when the way we have built the system, if you try to de-dollarize, the dollar goes up first.
Yeah, right.
That's basically how it works.
Yeah, absolutely. On that note, buddy, you talked to me about a new project you've got.
Yeah.
So can you kind of inform the viewers as to what's next for Macro Alf?
Yeah, I'm launching my own macro fund. So I used to run money for ING, this large European bank, until 2021. Then I quit and I started my own business. Nice and dandy to share information and knowledge with people, but there are so many investment opportunities out there. Yeah. As we discussed, George, I mean, all this macro volatility in growth and inflation will result in volatility for standard portfolios and needs to be hedged somehow or complemented with other exposures. And so a global macro fund like the one I will be opening tries to take advantage of all these opportunities worldwide. In any asset that pop up, in any currency, in any equity sector, there will be opportunities to exploit, right? And that's the idea of the macro fund. Be flexible, apply the framework that I have, risk manage, exactly like the discussion we had at the beginning of the podcast, and try to generate returns that are not correlated to equities and bonds, but they are the result of exploiting these opportunities that we just discussed around the world, be it in China, in the UK, in Canada, in the US, wherever they are. So I'm launching my own macro fund, and I just want to share the news with people because some of you guys might be interested in reaching out. If you are, please do. For regulatory reasons, I must disclose that the minimum allocation is $250,000. It's not up to me. It's up to regulators. The fund is fully regulated, third-party custodied, and everything. So that means there is a minimum allocation by law, $250,000. If you can want to meet that, you want more information, just reach out to me, an email to fund@themacrocompass.com, and I will share with you the information, or you can just reach out on Twitter. My messages are open. I'm here to help.
Fantastic, buddy. I can't wait. You'll have to keep us posted and tell us how that goes. Hey guys, I want to invite each and every one of you to join me May 31st through June 2nd in Orlando for Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the annual conference I do, and this year, it's going to be absolutely incredible. We're going to have some of your favorites there as speakers, guys like Jeff Snyder, Mike Green, Real Estate, Kenny McElroy. We're going to have Robert Barnes. They're talking about freedom and liberty. Even Rich Cooper is going to be there discussing red pill issues. This event is all about giving you the intel, the insider information you need to not only survive 2024, but thrive. The whole reason I created this event was to give you the tools you need to build the future you deserve for yourself and your family. This is an event you are not going to want to miss. So to get more information, go to rebelcapitalistlive.com. You can see a full list of speakers we've had in the past. You can see clips from past events. And most importantly, you can get your tickets. As we get closer to the event, the tickets go up in price. So you're going to want to get those ASAP at rebelcapitalistlive.com. And we will see you in Orlando, May 31st through June 2nd.